in many of these countries like Uganda, there's an opportunity to have a broad-based conversation around the implications of these technologies before they're made available. And that's an opportunity that we kind of missed because we can talk about genetically modified crops in Canada, but we can't turn back the clock and have that conversation 20 years ago.
Hi, and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. Today on Habitat, we focus on genetically modified crops. We start off with the GM apple. A company in BC has engineered an apple that won't turn brown after being cut. They call it the Arctic apple, and it's currently awaiting approval for consumption in the US and Canada. I spoke with Lucy Sherritt of the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network to find out more. Then later, we'll take the GM discussion all the way to Uganda. Matthew Schnurr is a Dalhousie professor researching the debate over the potential for genetically modified crops to improve yields and livelihoods in sub-Saharan Africa. And to finish off the hour, we have the fourth installment of Let's Talk Energy, produced at CHUO in Ottawa. So stay tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and the Rabble Podcast Network. Now, let's talk apples. Lucy Sherritt is the coordinator of the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. Thanks for joining us on Habitat, Lucy.
You're welcome.
So, what is the GM apple?
The genetically modified apple has been genetically engineered to not brown after it's been cut. So, once we cut apple flesh, it starts a process of browning. People know this. We put lemon juice on our apples. There's a vitamin C solution that the industry puts on apples because now we have like these little plastic bags of sliced apples. So there is a small company in British Columbia that has bought an Australian technology. They've improved it a little bit. And now they would like approval in Canada and the United States to put this genetically modified non-browning apple on the market for us to eat.
They've called it the Arctic apple.
That's the trademark name for it, is the Arctic apple.
I
the
see.
Company says, oh, this is, you know, just a simple change that we've made to the apple. Sometimes they call it an apple-to-apple transformation. What's happened here is that there is modified DNA from an apple that's inserted into the cells of this apple with DNA from bacteria and viruses. So there's a whole gene sequence from different species that's inserted into the apple to make it into a non-browning apple.
Now, when we make a new apple through genetic modification, how is that different than, I mean, we've heard of sort of new apples before, I guess coming through like husbandry, like the Honeycrisp comes to mind. There's been sort of new apples introduced over the years. How is that different?
It's very different in that the technology of genetic engineering means that in the laboratory, at the molecular level, scientists can move genes from one species to another, from one organism to another. And this is how now, instead of experimenting with different apple varieties in the field, grafting different apples onto different trees, the technology can be taken into the laboratory, and the industry argues this is more precise, that it allows them to seek out a specific trait that would be expressed by certain genes and to move that trait into the apple. So we would like a non-browning apple, or this is what the company tells us, and so they have created, through genetic modification, by moving certain DNA directly into that apple, they've triggered that response. So we now have a genetically modified non-browning apple. The interesting thing about the way that new varieties of apples are introduced is that oftentimes new varieties, or there are many varieties that we eat that are accidental apples, where in BC, apple seeds in a compost pile have resulted in the ambrosia apple, which is so popular, and a few other apples as well. And this itself points actually to the problem of potential contamination if we have GM apple seeds, for example.
Okay, yeah, let's talk a bit about some of the concerns around, I mean, we've spoken before about genetically modified salmon and other crops, alfalfa being another one that we've spoken about on the show before. In terms of your concerns, contamination has always been a big concern of GM crops. How would it work with these apples? What would it mean? What are the problems with contamination?
For contamination with the apple, certainly there's the issue of bees taking apple pollen around, which is a very big possibility. In British Columbia, where most of the apples in Canada are grown, there's over 100 different types of wild bees, but also this issue of the apple seeds themselves, and this is where we would see the biggest risk of the transfer of the new genetic material would be from people throwing an apple core out the window into on the roadside, or even this example of the compost pile. So the issue of contamination, certainly in British Columbia, where there's a critical mass of organic apple producers in the Okanagan Valley, they have said that they do not want this risk of contamination. And in fact, in 2001, the organic apple producers in British Columbia were so vocal about their concerns that in actual fact, the company that's produced the GM apple was never allowed to field test the apple in Canada, in BC. They've been field tested in the United States because the apple producers in BC were so opposed and did not want to see this risk at all to be a possibility. And so we see growers opposing the GM apple because of the risk of contamination, but we also see growers, certainly the BC Fruit Growers Association, has expressed their opposition to the genetically modified apple because they're also concerned about the consumer backlash, that they want to protect the market for apples as a wholesome, healthy food that people choose when they choose a fruit, and that they understand that there is a controversy around genetically modified foods, and they actually did a poll to test out their theory. And yes, 69% of Canadians do not want this GM apple approved. So actually, not just organic apple growers, but also conventional apple growers are more than just a little bit concerned. They're actively opposing the GM apple, and that actually includes growers in the United States as well. The big associations of apple growers don't want this on the market because they understand that enough consumers don't want genetically modified apples in the produce section.
Do we know if there's health risks related to GM foods, or is this a situation where the big concern is that we actually don't have enough information to know whether there are health risks?
Yeah, we don't know what, if any, health risks there are from eating genetically modified foods. And the question is exactly that, is where is the research to tell us that they're safe? It doesn't exist. All of the decisions that were taken to approve the genetically modified foods that we eat were taken based on corporate science generated by the companies that want to sell these products. And we never get to see that science. It hasn't been reviewed by independent scientists. It's not peer-reviewed science for the most part. And for something like the GM apple, in fact, there's not even animal feeding trials. So there's not a lot of science out there in the scientific literature on genetic engineering. And then there's a whole set of science that we never get to see that somehow is actually the foundation of all of the government decisions to allow these foods onto the market. So we definitely don't know enough. And certainly we would argue that this is a really complex science, and we actually need to look further about how do we evaluate risks. Do we know what we're looking for when we start asking these questions in the laboratory? How long do animal feeding trials need to be? Is 90 days enough? Or do we actually need to test foods on laboratory rats for their entire lifespan, which is 2 years? So there's some very key questions that really, it's very clear, actually, that the government is not regulating rigorously.
This is, you know, a small Canadian company. Although you mentioned that they've actually acquired this technology from a company in Australia, does it make a difference that this is a smaller biotech company instead of, say, Monsanto?
In another circumstance, it could make a big difference. But the interesting thing about regulation in Canada is you don't have to be Monsanto to bring forward a genetically modified product. This is a classic example. The genetically modified apple is a classic example of what's wrong with our regulatory system. Is any group of scientists or investors can bring forward a genetically modified non-browning apple, a fast-growing GM salmon, a product that no one wants or needs, with minimal testing. They just need to put together enough data and have just enough money to do that, present it to the Canadian government, and ask for approval. The GM apple could be a market flop. The GM fish could be a market flop. We know that the economic impacts of both of those look really dire. You know, apple growers don't want the GM apple. The public doesn't want the GM apple. None of those questions are relevant in regulation. The only thing the company needs to do is give the Canadian government just enough information, and then we spend, as taxpayers, a great deal of money and time assessing a product that no one wants and needs. So while Monsanto does own over 80% of all the GM crops currently grown in the world, the kind of regulatory system that we have is set up such that now anyone can come forward with genetically modified crops. Monsanto and other companies have set it up so that that's the case.
So like one of the concerns would be that even like what some might describe as sort of a trivial genetic change to an apple, i.e. stopping it from browning, gets the full attention of our regulatory agencies.
Absolutely.
Even though it doesn't really advance humankind very far.
Absolutely. And we could argue that that's the case with all of the genetically modified crops that have been approved. It's just that something like this GM apple really shows us really what's going on here, that there's not a consensus in society that this product is great. Yeah, let's spend a lot of money really, you know, developing the science and then, you know, testing it and the risk assessment and then testing it on the market. No, we're just ready to, you know, offer up our regulatory system so that, you know, anything could sort of pass by there. And then it's down to consumers to sort of try and communicate to the government if they have a problem with the product, or for farmers to try and communicate the risks of a genetically modified alfalfa, for example. And this is just not sustainable in the long term. This kind of public battle over genetically modified foods is happening because there's no public consultation. Everything happens in secret. There's no agreement in our society about, do we want this new technology? If we want to use it, how do we want to introduce it? How do we want to evaluate it?
You mentioned, some of the opposition from the growers in BC. I'm wondering if one of the concerns is the whole idea that a genetically modified organism is a proprietary thing. As opposed to your average apple, which I don't believe is proprietary, like anyone can grow a Macintosh if they desire. Is that one of the concerns that the growers have, that they're going to, you know, risk being sued by a company that says, we own that apple that's growing on that tree because it's been cross-pollinated or something?
It is a concern. In the case of the GM apple, it's not the primary concern,
okay,
but it has been raised because this is the one of the issues with genetic engineering in particular is when scientists develop this new gene sequence and put it into the apple, for example, they own that sequence. So Monsanto owns, you know, gene sequences in corn and canola and soy, and this BC company, Okanagan Specialty Foods, they will own that gene combination. And if farmers find that gene combination in apple trees several years down the line, there's an open question as to whether or not there is a legal case, because actually that's not their property. If they're taking advantage of that trait, if they're benefiting from that non-browning apple, that is supposed to be money going into the pockets of Okanagan specialty fruits. And if they wanted to, they could enforce that patent protection. That is one of the differences in practicality between, because you had asked about the difference between a product coming from Monsanto and coming from a smaller company, is a company like Monsanto has more resources to enforce their patent protection.
They can sue as many farmers as they like without worrying.
And they can intimidate as many farmers as they like. And that would be less of an issue, presumably, with a small company. But I do know that growers have already expressed concern about it. And there's no legal framework in Canada to protect farmers who find that gene sequence in their field. It's a very confusing situation. And because contamination happens, it's something that we keep seeing again and again, but there's no legal recourse.
If Canadian law changed, I mean, and this is probably not very likely to happen, but if Canada decided that, you know what, you can't own a gene sequence in Canada, it's ownership is not possible. So genetically modified anything is just, it exists in the world and whoever has it owns it. Would that change GM organisms in food for you? Would that solve one of the key problems, or would you still see some problems?
It would change the character of how this technology is introduced, and it might mean that actually companies switch to other technologies. The interesting thing is that genetic engineering does facilitate corporate control, and it is a technology that allows companies to take ownership over seed. But actually, there are already laws in place that allow for some level of corporate control over seed. And the Canadian government is about to pass a bill, Bill C-18, that would move that law even further to take even more control over seed, to allow for more private ownership over plant breeders' rights. So genetic engineering for companies resolves some of the messy questions about how they can make sure that they can legally own the seed and control the market. But governments, certainly the Canadian government, is interested in protecting the interests of corporations, regardless of which technology they use. And then there are other technologies that companies might move to replace genetic engineering if they can get the same type of ownership advantage from new technologies. So the question into the future is an interesting one. Certainly we know that decision to allow for the patenting of life did mean that genetic engineering became very attractive. It is the core reason why we're in the situation that we are. And it also exposes the core social problem with genetic engineering, this issue of corporate control, and this idea that we, you know, corporations can own life, and that the seed, which is the very basis of our food system that needs to be in the hands of farmers and people, is increasingly in the hands of corporations. And the patenting issue is definitely the core of how we would begin to get that control back and make sure that into the future farmers and people actually have collective access to all of that rich heritage from so many millennia of the work that farmers have done.
Well, it's an interesting and important topic. We'll keep following it. What should people be paying attention to in the coming days and months regarding the GM apple?
The genetically modified apple is going to be reviewed over the next, you know, year by our regulatory agencies in Canada and the U.S. It could be approved late this year, early next year. But really what's happening is that it's very clear that there is a market rejection for the GM apple, or that market rejection actually needs to become clear so that the apple doesn't get approved. And consumers have a huge influential role to play in stopping the GM apple. If people are concerned about the GM apple, if they don't want it, then now is a great time to write a letter to the head office of your grocery chain. If you're buying fruits and vegetables from a grocery store, you can ask the manager of that grocery store to make a pledge never to carry the GM apple. And you can write to the head office of the grocery store to ask for that pledge. And that is so influential because the grocery stores don't need to be carrying a GM apple. They don't care. They want to carry what consumers will buy. And it's becoming so evident right now that there is, you know, this upswell of consumer concern about genetic modification across the US and Canada. So grocery stores are paying attention and people can take action today. That would be really strong action.
Thanks so much for your time today, Lucy. That was Lucy Sherritt of the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. You can find them at cban.ca. Next, we'll take the GM crop discussion over to Uganda. We speak with a Dalhousie researcher who's been looking into what small-scale subsistence farmers are thinking about GM crops. Matthew Schnurr is an associate professor in the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie. He is researching the debate over the potential for genetically modified crops to improve yields and livelihoods in sub-Saharan Africa. Welcome to Habitat, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
On this show, we've talked a lot about GM crops in North America, but can you give us an idea of the state of GM crops in Africa? How common they are, how well accepted, and what the main issues that people are debating about them over there?
Yeah. So the debate around the potential for GM crops to help African farmers started around 15 years ago. And initially, the focus was on the GM crops that we use here, so herbicide-resistant cotton, pesticide-resistant soybean, that kind of thing. But more recently, it's developed into a debate around using African carbohydrate staples. So these are crops that basically only Africans eat, crops like cassava and sorghum and cowpea that amount for a large that account for a large proportion of the calories consumed in Africa, and genetically modifying those carbohydrates to help farmers increase their yields and hopefully their economic outputs. So as of right now, there's only 4 countries in Africa that have legislated the commercialization of genetically modified crops. Mm-hmm. South Africa was the first one back in the late 90s. And since then, Egypt, Sudan, and Burkina Faso have followed suit. There are about half a dozen other countries that are currently experimenting with genetically modified crops. And right now, a lot of enthusiasm on the part of development donors, corporations, and individuals about the potential for these technologies to really help agriculture.
Mm. So when the companies, the 4 countries that have legislated, or that means that they have a regulation system around genetically modified crops, like they have a system in place to evaluate and allow, sort of like Canadian Food Inspection Agency sort of equivalent.
Exactly. So in order to grow genetically modified crops, the national government has to pass legislation saying this is what we're going to do. And in order to do that, you have to meet certain criteria about risk assessment and confined field trials and food safety and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there are only 4 nations that have gotten to the point that they're willing to commercialize these broadly and allow their farmers to grow it and their consumers to eat it. A number of other nations have started implementing regulations that allow them to experiment with these technologies in the lab, in the field, but they haven't passed legislation yet to really grow them widely across the country.
Okay. So, and until the governments are approving that, it's not something that's able to happen like Wild West style, basically.
Exactly. Okay. The national government has to pass that legislation. So, for example, in Uganda, which is the country I work in, they have a biotechnology and biosafety bill. It was drafted back in 2006. It's gone through multiple readings by cabinet and parliament. It's currently under debate. But until that legislation passes, genetically modified crops cannot be planted outside of the experiment stations.
Okay. So your research project, as you just mentioned, you're in Uganda. You are looking at the acceptance of the genetically modified Matoke banana. Is that?
Yeah, Matoke.
Matoke banana among small subsistence farmers.
Right.
So what What's the essential question you're asking with your research?
So matoke banana is, it's a very different crop than the banana we're used to. It's not a banana that you sort of peel and eat when it's ripe. Ugandans eat it before it's ripe, and what they do is they peel it and then boil it and then mash it, roast it over a fire for about 4 to 6 hours. And what you end up with is this kind of mashed banana that's almost like the consistency of mashed potatoes. And so this matoke, this mashed banana, is by far the most important carbohydrate in Uganda. It accounts for somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% of the country's daily caloric intake. Bananas are everywhere. In fact, Ugandans actually consume more bananas per capita than anyone else on the planet. So this is an enormously important crop for Ugandans. And it's a crop that also smallholder farmers grow, larger farmers grow, but they encounter a lot of challenges. They encounter challenges with insect pests. They encounter challenges with diseases. There's also concerns about the low nutritional content. So what happened about 10 years ago was that the Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, negotiated with private corporations to give their genetically modified technologies license-free to government scientists in Uganda, so that these scientists could start experimenting with genetically modified versions of matoke that would be resistant to the most pernicious pests and diseases. They also have a genetically modified version under experimentation that's biofortified to increase the content of vitamin A and iron to help improve maternal and infant health outcomes. So there's a lot of enthusiasm around the possibilities for genetically modified matoke to help African farmers. And our research is really focused on talking to the farmers themselves and asking questions about whether these technologies, which aren't commercialized yet, but certainly will be soon, are appropriate given the circumstances they encounter on the ground.
So that's interesting. So the origins of the research are coming from private entities, and then it's going into a government lab. If new strains or new, like, if new, I don't know what you call it, a new version of the matoke banana comes out of a government lab, would it then be available license-free to farmers?
That's right. So the programs for the genetically modified crops that are grown in Africa, a number of them are protected under intellectual property. So Monsanto's genetically modified cotton is grown in South Africa, and their farmers have to pay every year for the patent and sign the stewardship agreement. So similar patterns of adoption that we see here in Canada. But the second wave of genetically modified crops in Africa, this focus on those carbohydrate staple crops, cassava, sorghum, cowpea, all those experimental programs are premised on the idea that farmers won't have to pay for the intellectual property, that the technology will be given license-free, for free to these farmers in order to help them improve their outcomes.
So it'll essentially be owned by the government then?
Yeah, exactly. They've waived their intellectual property. So in this case, you're right. It's owned by the scientists who work for the Ugandan government, but they're able to distribute it to farmers far and wide without any concerns about, you know, replanting or sharing or those kinds of concerns that we see with patent-protected genetically modified crops.
Creative commons for genetic modification.
Yeah.
Interesting. How, like, I don't want to be cynical, but how did the Gates Foundation convince private corporations to give up the initial technology?
So
did they pay for it, or
there was no money exchanged? Yeah, I think it's a combination. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the most powerful organization in the international development industry right now. And you can't underestimate how much clout and influence they have. They are also extremely well connected with business, both, of course, in the information technology sector, but also in the agricultural sector as well. So I think part of it was that they were a high-level organization with the resources and the individuals who were able to gain access to the boards and CEOs of these big companies and talk about the merits of engaging in this kind of work. I think also that these private corporations, the owners of these intellectual property, also recognized that there were benefits for them to give these technologies for free for these kinds of projects. First benefit, of course, is public relations, because then a corporation, an agricultural corporation like Monsanto, can make the claim that it is engaging in this kind of work not just to make money, but also to really help the poor and most vulnerable. And also, I think it's important to understand the sort of the global geopolitics around genetic modification. You know, there's a very uneven uptake of these technologies around the world. They've been embraced enthusiastically in North and South America. They're increasingly on the rise in China and India. There's been a lot of resistance and opposition in Europe. And Africa is one of sort of the last frontiers for this debate around genetically modified crops. So there are some more cynical activists and scholars who suggest that this is almost a Trojan horse, a way for these corporations to gain a foothold in African markets, gain legislation that is very open and supportive of genetically modified crops, mm-hmm. to allow them later to bring in the other patent-protected technologies that could really allow them to disseminate that technology more widely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's interesting because, I mean, there's a good, you know, it, well, just in the people I've spoken to about GM crops in North America, a good percentage of the opposition to them is just the ownership structure,
right?
The ownership structure over seed and like, yeah. So, it's interesting unraveling of how it's going there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different model of ownership and technology development than we saw with genetically modified crops that are grown in this country. And so in that sense, you know, we really have to ask, I think, specific questions, not about, you know, are you pro-GM technology or anti-GM technology, but does this particular technology make sense in this particular place? Mm-hmm. And you're right, there are nuances to the debate around using genetically modified crops in Africa that play out in very different ways than they do in Canada and other parts, wealthier parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking to small farmers. What are you hearing from them? Like, give us a sense of the structure of your research and who you're talking to and, you know, and how and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So our project combines quantitative and qualitative methods. So we tried to create a representative random sample of farmers from across the country in the hopes that we can extrapolate from those conversations and try to generalize about farmers' attitudes towards genetically modified matoke more generally. So we've talked to about 200 farmers from across the country over the better part of a year and a half. And we use sort of two major methodologies. The first is what's known as participatory ranking exercises. You know, genetically modified technologies are very technical, very jargon heavy, and most of the farmers in Uganda are illiterate or semi-literate. So what we rely on heavily is sort of hypothetical scenarios, visual aids, side-by-side comparisons in order to talk about the behaviors, the advantages, the limitations of genetically modified crops in a way that farmers can understand and then offer their opinion and insights. So that's the quantitative part. After talking to farmers across the country and getting a representative sense of how they feel about these technologies, we then use focus groups, so, you know, longer-term sustained conversations to really try to probe farmers and get a sense of why they feel the way they do about these technologies. And that's the way we've been talking to farmers and trying to sort of assimilate their perspectives for the past, about 20 months.
Mm-hmm. No, I guess you're not able to like probably summarize your findings. It's still ongoing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but can you give us a sense of what you think you're hearing, like what the conclusions might be coming out of it?
Sure. I mean, there's, you know, the I think the first important thing to emphasize is sometimes I think people homogenize African farmers and say, you know, a lot of people who trumpet these technologies say, well, African farmers are going to, you know, are enthusiastically embrace genetically modified crops because they're poor, because there's a lot of hunger. And other people say, well, African farmers are peasants and they're going to, you know, unilaterally resist these technologies. And what we found is just like among farmers in Canada and the United States, there's a real plurality of perspectives. Some farmers are really enthusiastic about the possibility for these technologies to help. Others are really skeptical and concerned about potential health and environmental challenges. So our preliminary analysis suggests that there are certain variables that significantly influence whether a farmer is going to be enthusiastic about genetically modified matoke. So we know that a larger farmer generally is going to be more positive about genetically modified matoke than a smaller farmer.
Hmm.
We know that farmers who are more heavily marketized, so farmers who grow more matoke to sell on the market rather than subsistence farmers who grow for themselves, are more enthusiastic. And we also notice that there's a trend towards women being more hesitant, female farmers being more hesitant about GM crops than are men. The other thing we're finding is that there are, you know, it's difficult to have these conversations about whether genetically modified crops make sense without looking at the wider context. And so what we find when we talk to farmers about genetically modified crops, they talk about issues that are important to them, but not necessarily about the technology. So they talk about issues like access to markets. They talk about issues of access to credit. So there are certain potential impediments to the adoption of genetically modified matoke, like the fact that you would have to pay for the planting material. Banana start as suckers. And right now, farmers can exchange their suckers. And if you have a sucker, you can give it to me, and I'll give you about 500 Ugandan shillings, and I'll plant that sucker, and I'll be happy. And in order to plant genetically modified matoke, they'll need to go to a nursery to buy a sucker that has been produced from the experimental farm. And what that means is they're going to have to pay about six times as much for that planting material. That's not because of the intellectual property. It's because those planting materials have to be prepared on the lab, and so they have to pay more for them. So that's one of the kind of associated realities of these technologies that farmers have identified as a potential hindrance that don't figure very prominently in the debate right now.
Yeah. Would that be a one-time expense for them, though?
It would.
Because then they can, once they have the sucker,
they can grow it over and over again.
It's like they can harvest their own seed.
Totally. Except that we also know that eventually there's going to be resistant varieties. I mean, we know that, you know, if a matoke variety is bred to resist a particular insect, after a certain amount of time, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, that genetically modified version is going to not be, the insect's going to develop resistance to that genetically modified version. You'll need to kind of update your planting materials. So they will have the opportunity to replant over the long term, but eventually they'll have to replenish their planting materials. We just don't know how long that will take.
Are there issues with matoke banana right now? Like are the history of those of the conventional style of growing those crops, has that come upon hard times? Like, is there a reason why, I guess, there's a need to focus on that banana, and a reason why it's needs help or needs, you know?
Like, yeah, definitely. I mean, the first thing, definitely in talking to farmers around the country, I mean, farmers are suffering. You know, there's a lot of pests and diseases that are more prominent now than they were in years past. There's one disease which is called banana bacterial wilt, which is only appeared in the first time in Uganda about 15 years ago, and now it's just devastating, especially parts, the southwestern part of the country. So farmers definitely want help in accessing matoke varieties that are more resistant to these diseases. The other thing about matoke and that crop in particular is that banana is a sterile crop. It reproduces clonally. So unlike other crops that are easier to improve via traditional breeding, breeding banana is really tricky. And over the years, plant scientists have had very little success in breeding improved varieties through conventional means. So there's a lot of optimism among banana breeders that genetic modification could help them produce these disease and pest resistant varieties that they wouldn't be able to achieve through other means.
Right. There's a lot of crops that we've been hybridizing just with traditional methods all this time.
Right.
Okay.
And you can do that with banana. It's just a lot harder to do.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned that you've seen a pattern that the people with larger farms that are less likely to be just subsistence farmers, but more, you know, taking crops to market, are more enthusiastic, and the smaller subsistence farmers maybe less. Not that that's a general rule, but do you have any theories as to why that is?
When we talk to farmers and sort of probe them about that, a lot of the larger farmers who are producing matoke that's primarily consumed in the urban region are, you know, focused especially on yields, right? The larger the bunch, the more they're going to get for it. And so their production system is really focused on, you know, growing matoke to make money rather than growing to feed their families. For the farmers who are subsistence first, we heard some more concerns around potential health and environmental repercussions of these technologies. We also heard a lot of farmers citing spiritual and religious and ethical reasons for being very skeptical. And a lot of farmers talked about having a lot of faith in the varieties that had been around, that they had eaten since they were children and their ancestors had eaten, and some concerns about a new breeding technology that could only be done in the lab and what the consequences could be for their health and consumption. So our sense is that those kinds of very personal and familial concerns are more pronounced in smaller farmers than they are in larger farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's a different mindset when you know you're actually, the food you're growing is for yourself. Whereas if all you need to do is make sure it gets sold and it looks good, and it's in maybe a different kind of frame of mind. Yeah. So the government is spearheading this research. And how do you when you're done with this research, who will you be sharing it with? What kind of use will you be putting it to?
Yeah. So one of the big things we're committed to as part of this research is trying to inform debates in multiple audiences outside of just the scholarly one. So one of the audiences we really want to engage with is the policy audience, because our goal is really to create or help inform agricultural policies or experimental programs that are driven by farmer priorities and concerns. So what we're doing, I'm going back to Kampala in May, and at that point we're holding a 2-day workshop that'll bring together policy experts, development donors, research scientists, media, NGOs, civil society organizations, as well as a number of the farmers who have participated in our research. And the goal is to bring those diverse audiences together to allow these farmers to articulate their on-the-ground responses to these technologies. And the hope is to be able to feed that back in and affect policies that are a little more farmer-centered. We're also planning follow-up workshops in all the communities we worked in, because we want to make sure, first of all, that the people who gave their time to participate in our research are aware of the final results and what farmers elsewhere said, and allow them an opportunity to sort of to comment and explain or anything like that on the initial results, but also to feed those results back into the local level. So district level officials, local farmers associations, that sort of thing. And then the final debate we're hoping to influence both in Uganda and back home is this kind of public debate. In Uganda, the debate around GMOs is very narrow. It's really among, you know, the experts, the university professors and the government scientists and some policy officials. And when you try to have a broader conversation in my conversations with a lot of these people in Uganda who are really enthusiastic about genetically modified crops, I'll often ask, so, you know, what do farmers think about this technology? Does it make sense for them? And the attitude is often, well, you know, let's figure out the science first. Let's get the legislation in place. And when the technology is ready to be commercialized, then we'll tell farmers what it's all about. And there's also a lot of... there isn't a lot of confidence that these farmers will be able to understand and articulate intelligent views about these technologies. And so what we're hoping to do is kind of remind people that farmers actually have very thoughtful, nuanced, intelligent, diverse views on this subject. And we're hoping that we'll be able to bring those voices more to the fore of the debate in the public realm in Uganda.
Interesting. So, yeah, you're helping to bring those voices to help the policymakers understand those voices, basically.
Yeah, and hopefully create more of a conversation between the people in sort of these expert positions who are making the decisions about the direction of genetically modified crops in Uganda, and these farmers who are, you know, supposed to be the intended beneficiaries. I mean, the people who are ultimately going to decide whether genetically modified crops make sense in Africa is going to be African farmers. So it would. What we're hoping to do is sort of create more of a reciprocal relationship within a conversation that has really so far been quite one-sided.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, certainly the way some genetically modified crops are playing out in Canada, although I guess there's a variety of them, so it depends. But sometimes there's a lot of resistance from farmers So it's interesting because you'd think the farmers would be the ultimate market, like they have to be the ones who are growing it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's organized resistance from farmers, but yet it's still, they still proliferate. I guess. It's an interesting balance because, I mean, what you're saying you'd like to happen in Uganda is also what I hear people often say about Canadian policy around genetically modified organisms, that we would like to have a national debate about it,
mm-hmm.
which people feel we haven't had, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think it's I mean, we're also seeing those same kinds of diversity in views in parts of Africa. So in South Africa, where genetically modified crops have been grown and eaten for the better part of 15 years, you have farming organizations and unions and NGOs that are springing up that are largely dedicated to, you know, articulating concerns and hesitations around these technologies. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that bringing farmers' voices to the fore means that it's going to be a unified voice.
Right.
But I certainly agree with those who are calling for a broader conversation in this country. I mean, in many of these countries like Uganda, there's an opportunity to have a broad-based conversation around the implications of these technologies before they're made available.
Right.
And that's an opportunity that we kind of missed because we can talk about genetically modified crops in Canada, but we can't turn back the clock and have that conversation 20 years ago. So there's an opportunity in terms of the timing in the African context that I think is particularly important.
So interesting. Well, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today, Matthew Schnurr.
It was my pleasure.
All right.
You tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and the Rabble Podcast Network. We're just about done with the show today, but first, here's episode 4 of Let's Talk Energy.
You're listening to Talk Energy, where we hear from Canadians across the country, talk with a variety of energy experts, and explore lessons from Canada's energy history. Our mission? To find out what it means to understand energy and why understanding energy is so important for Canadians. My name is Ophira Horowitz, and I want to know, are you ready to talk energy? On a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is not important and 10 is super important, how important is energy to you and why?
7, and it's important because we all consume lots of energy and it makes the world go round.
I feel like I don't appreciate energy because, I don't know, it's just there.
Probably 8 because, I care about the environment, but on a more selfish level as a student, it costs a lot of money, and living downtown and then having to pay for heating and lighting and water in addition to that is very hard.
If you could ask an energy expert anything totally on the spot, what would it be?
Why aren't we exploiting geothermal more in the world?
What is the best way to be self-sustainable in terms of as an individual?
What kind of things have you personally done to save on energy? And are you willing to make changes to your lifestyle or pay even more dollars to save energy?
I try to do alternatives if I'm not in a room, always turning the light off and things like that. Just only using energy when I really need to.
I think just turning off the lights more. You know, using the dishwasher or the dryer or washer at time periods where, you know, it's cheaper.
We just heard from Canadians across the country. Now we turn to someone deeply involved in the energy conversation south of the border. Gregory Kallenberg is the director and producer of the Rational Middle Energy series. He deeply believes that people can come together to find balanced and rational solutions to some of the world's most pressing challenges, including using viable sources of energy for the future. Gregory, what does energy literacy mean for you?
Energy literacy to me is really understanding one of the most important issues that face us as a people of the globe. I mean, when you look at energy, energy gives us so many things, and yet people understand so little about it. So to me, the idea of energy literacy is something we should all strive for.
Why is it so important that people learn about energy?
It's important because, you know, we all have this weird sense of entitlement that when we turn on the light switch, you know, the light bulb is going to glow, but we have no idea of its impact. And I think that it's incredibly important to understand where energy comes from, how much we use of it, And what, you know, an energy future could hold is really, it's essential to our being, but it's also kind of essential to the future life that we want for ourselves.
Now, what's one thing about energy that every Canadian needs to know?
I think that every Canadian needs to know that Canada is such an incredible source, or that Canada has incredible resources of energy, and with great power comes great responsibility, you know, to kind of steal from Spider-Man a bit, is, you know, this whole idea is that, you know, that Canada is, you know, has this chance to lead the rest of the world as far as what sustainable energy development means. And again, I mean, I think it's a blessing and a curse to be in that place, and it's something that every Canadian should think deeply about.
The Rational Middle Energy Series is all about people developing a balanced opinion on energy, hearing the pros and the cons so that they can make an educated decision. And this is incredibly hard to do. What do you think the biggest obstacles are to energy literacy, and what can we do about them?
Yeah, so I think that right now we're in this very strange time where polarization is kind of the rule of the day, where you have people standing on disparate sides of the spectrum and hurling sort of ideologies at one another instead of working on a compromise solution. And I think that when you look at that huge obstacle that stands in front of everyone, it's that psychological barrier that you have to move through. So you wind up in a place like the middle, like the rational middle, where you sit down and you put those ideologies aside and you work on a civil solutions-based discussion. And it's so much easier said than done, but it's something that's essential to moving forward when you think about the energy future. And I think that it's very simple to live on one side of the issue or the other side of the issue because you are standing amongst like-minded individuals. I mean, it's really the mavericks that are willing to sort of leave their galvanized positions and go to a place and have that discussion. But again, it's a discussion that has to take place if we're going to start thinking about that energy future that we all want to live in.
It seems that the consensus is everyone wants to save energy, but at the same time, we want our bananas in January. We want to fly off to exotic destinations. We want those little parts to make our cell phones work. It seems that energy is something everyone wants to use, but nobody wants to talk about saving. How do people reconcile those two desires? Why is there that difference?
Well, you know, again, I think it goes back to the idea that there is a sense of entitlement when it comes to energy always being there for you. But, you know, again, I mean, discussion has to take place at some point about the impact of that energy. And so, you know, I think at the end of the day, you're right. I mean, everybody wants their cake, but nobody is willing to kind of really go to, you know, the bakery to kind of help bake that cake. And I think that really getting people, I mean, what I try to do with my documentary Haynesville is really kind of put that in front of people, like really have people see the cost benefit and the risk reward and all the inputs that you have to have if you're going to make a decision. And I want to make it clear, you know, the film Haynesville is not a film that is supposed to tell you how to think. It's a film much like The Rational Middle that is put out there to make you, you know, make you think about those issues and sort of work them out yourself. You kind of touch on something pretty interesting, which is, you know, the idea of conservation sounds great in theory, but you almost have to track it back to what people do about it in practice. And it becomes very difficult when you start telling people that they only have, you know, 15 minutes to look at Facebook every night, not 5 hours. You know, you're starting to impede on what they consider their freedom to be, you know.
These days, stopping consuming is almost like stopping being human.
Absolutely. And you know, it's such a first world problem, you know, as it's been put to me before, you know, where, you know, we have to think about all those things on making the world a better place. But, you know, a lot of them are not necessarily that they're hard, but just it's not what people want to do. And I think that's a quandary. You know, we actually have a film about conservation and efficiency with The Rational Middle, and it asks that very question. I mean, is it something where conservation is an achievable goal, or should we kind of go more for efficiency so that it becomes, you know, a lot less human intensive to actually start saving energy? I mean, you touched on something that's a third rail at the end of the day when it comes to energy.
Now, Gregory, finally, I'd like to ask, you're from New Orleans. What do you think is special about the Canadian conversation around energy?
You know, I'm actually from Shreveport, Louisiana, which is north of New Orleans. But I had to say that what I appreciate most about Canada and the Canadian views on energy, and you know, by the way, we have two or three episodes that are focused on Canadian energy picture on Rational Metal. I think that what is most heartening to me is that it seems to be a more energy aware community. You know, I don't think that the policy is where it needs to be in Canada, but it certainly has a citizenry that appreciates and knows a little bit more about energy than the U.S. does. And I think that makes a big difference when you start talking about the inroads that have to be made in order to create that energy future. And, you know, to me, Canada and Canadians are going to be the ones that, if they take the initiative, can be sort of the global leaders as to the way energy gets developed and the energy future gets crafted.
We just got a contemporary perspective on energy. Now let's turn to the past for lessons from our energy history. Today we're sitting down with Sean Tudor, Assistant Curator at the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation. He is an expert in many fields, but today we will be discussing the development of the vertical axis wind turbine in Canada. Sean, let's rock and roll.
So the vertical axis wind turbine was developed at the National Research Council by Raj Rangi and Peter Self starting in 1966, but they actually didn't invent it. They're credited with the rediscovery. Georges Darius invented it or patented it in 1931, but did nothing with the patent. So here we have an example of a spontaneous co-creation of a technology. So what they did was they developed this vertical axis wind turbine. It's like a giant egg beater. Think of it as a giant egg beater. And they built it for remote communities to help in industrializing nations, nations that don't necessarily have access to the same grid that we have in North America. So this project started to grow and gained legs in Canada in the early 1970s during the oil crisis, and started in 1973. And part of that, it gaining legs, was it received federal funding to start to develop these prototype wind turbines all the way across the country. And in fact, one of these 1970s prototypes still exists. You can go see it on Les Îles de la Madeleine, or Madeleine Islands in English, and that's just off the Gaspé Peninsula. So if you are out that way, you should go and have a look. It's quite pretty. The whole scenery is quite pretty. But that's the last one that's remaining. The project culminated in the 1980s with a large megawatt-sized wind turbine, and this is an absolutely massive turbine. And you can see it actually at Cap Shaw in the Gaspé Peninsula. It's still in existence as well. But what happened is, as these turbines got bigger, their footprint, their physical bases got bigger and bigger and bigger, which made them kind of impractical for urban settings or quasi-rural settings. So as the oil crisis ended in the mid-1980s, the wind turbine development project kind of got shelved at the National Research Council. But the 1990s came along, and larger fears about global warming and climate change came along, and this project actually got new life in northern Canada at being used in remote communities to help supplement the use of diesel in the winter. So when the winds were blowing strong in these northern communities in the winter, these vertical axis wind turbines actually just helped to take the edge off and create enough electricity to not use diesel as much.
This program was brought to you by Let's Talk Energy, an initiative of the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation, in partnership with your local community radio station. This segment was co-produced by Let's Talk Energy and CHUO 89.1 FM. Thank you to CHUO in Ottawa, CJSR in Edmonton, and CKDU in Halifax for providing interviews with Canadians from across the country. Special thanks to host Afira Horowitz and sound editor Adriana White.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and ravel.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca, or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening. Habitat.